Case number 14-1185, Laura Sands, petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Solman for the petitioner, Mr. Engelhardt for the respondent, and Mr. Kappas for the intervener.
May it please the court, my name is Aaron Solem. I represent petitioner Laura Sands. Per the court's directive, I'm going to spend my time discussing mootness, as this case, I think we can all agree, on the merits is controlled by Penrod and this court's decision in Abrams. We contend this case is not moot because Sands still maintains her right to a notice posting remedy. This court and other courts
have she's announced. Do we have any reason to think that she'll return to work at Kroger?
No.
I mean, in fact, she said the otherwise, right? So what's her interest in the posting?
Right. Her interest in the question is the notice posting is an affirmative remedy. It's the traditional board remedy, and that applies even when the resumption of unfair labor practice is unlikely.
There's no interested party pressing for that? I mean, the cases that you cite are all cases where the board has a continuing interest, the union has a continuing interest. I couldn't find any cases where the employee who's no longer party who has a possible interest, but the employee is no longer
in response to the board's 28J letter last Friday, which cited Galley. We cited Montague in our response yesterday. Montague dealt from the Sixth Circuit, dealt with two employees. The factory was sold. They no longer work for that employer. The union was no longer trying to attempt to represent them. What is at issue in Montague was a case that dealt with a pre-recognition agreement, and the union never even represented the employees in Montague. Yet the Sixth Circuit held that the notice posting still kept the case alive because of the board's interest, and the employees still had Article III standing to challenge
the board obviously isn't seeking that. Right. Isn't that the difference between this case and the Sixth Circuit?
No. The board is seeking a notice posting, and well, they sought a notice posting below. Mm-hmm. And just like in Montague, the charging party lost before the board. And the Sixth Circuit found in Montague that it was sufficient to have Article III standing. And I just want to say it's consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Knox, which held that as long as any remedy remains, no matter how slight, although we wouldn't say a notice posting is slight, that it still gives a petitioner Article III standing. And the board really cites no cases, nor does the union cite any cases, that deal with a case where the petitioner sought a notice posting.
You're also seeking the money back, right?
She is seeking the money back. The union now has tendered a refund. It's tendered, and we would admit it's more than she could have received otherwise. She's not cashed the check. She's rejected the check. Well, we don't think Campbell Ewald has.
What do you mean she's rejected the check?
Well, she hasn't cashed it. It's more than 6 months old. She is not going to cash the check. She could still receive an order from the board.
But you've said in your opening, in your reply brief, you've said that, quote, she lacks standing for this remedy, that is standing, that is money damages. That's what you say in your reply brief.
I think your
whole argument here is waived. You say you're reading from the reply brief. The union, however, has refunded all of her dues after she filed. So she now lacks this remedy.
Yeah. I think we're inarticulate in saying.
You think what?
I think it was inarticulate. I think it should have been she was tendered dues because
unless she is cash, in the reply brief, in no uncertain terms, that she, quote, lacks this remedy. That's a waiver.
Yeah. I don't think it's been waived because, you know, Campbell Ewald was cited, and we were just attempting to differentiate
from
Campbell Ewald.
I'm just talking about what you said in your brief.
That's all. I think it's a fact. Unless she actually has cashed the check, I don't think she's actually, my client has actually accepted the money. And I don't
think
that is.
That. I didn't say that at all. Uh-huh. I take your point about that. Just tell me once again why, just from a litigation point of view, from, you know, filing a brief response and all that, why this sentence doesn't waive your argument about standing to seek a monetary damage.
Why she doesn't? Because she hasn't actually received the money. She's received a check.
No, in terms of what you said in your brief.
In terms of what I said in the brief,
Do you see the sentence I'm talking about?
Yes, I understand the sentence you're talking about. It says she was refunded.
Yeah.
She was refunded dues.
And so just tell me.
I think looking at Campbell-Ewald.
You may be right. I just need to hear the argument.
Yeah. Looking at Campbell-Ewald and understanding what it said there, when there's a rejected settlement offer, Rule 68 purpose, and that we were just merely attempting to distinguish that case from the board citation of Campbell-Ewald here. And just looking at the actual facts, she has not actually received the money. She's received a check, but she hasn't cashed it, and the check is old. It may not be cashable at this point.
When did you learn that? That's not part of your brief, is it? That she received it but didn't cash it? When did you learn that?
When did I learn that?
After you wrote the brief.
Yes.
Well, Campbell-Ewald prompted you to make the argument that you weren't otherwise making.
Yeah, the board's citation of Campbell-Ewald last Friday prompted us to make this distinction. But Campbell-Ewald doesn't hold a lot of...
Because how many found out that she hadn't cashed the check?
We've known for a couple months now, but looking at Campbell-Ewald, we didn't really think it was even important after reading that decision to cite it.
Has she not cashed the check? Maybe you don't want to say this, so don't answer it if you don't. Has she not cashed the check because she doesn't want to move the case?
I don't know if that's the answer, but she doesn't want to move. She doesn't want to have the case be moot, and she still wants to enforce the board's notice posting for certain.
Right, I know. I'm just talking about the check part. I realize I'm trying to keep distinct. They're two separate ways. This might not be moot.
Yeah. Right. But I just want to I want to be clear. I keep trying to come back to this, is that we don't think Campbell-Ewald, this discussion, really has a lot of pertinence in the fact that the notice posting remedy still remains.
But if that's why I'm bringing up the check. If we disagree with you on that, then all you have is the check.
No. I think we also have something else, and we have the Eighth Circuit's decision in Bloom, which gives third-party standing.
Oh, yeah.
And this is another issue that it's the briefs are frankly very light on this in terms of opposing our position, but SAND stands as a class representative. The board's notice posting and remedial power, she's as a charging party, and the board, she stands in place of the board. And the board sought a similarly situated remedy below in the complaint. It says not only violated SAM's rights.
Is there any hindrance to other Kroger workers pursuing this?
Well, yes.
I thought our third standing analysis required that there be some hindrance before she can invoke third-party standing.
It requires that there to be similarly situated, and they are hindered if they all received a defective Beck notice, because they have to make, as this court found in Penrod, as the Supreme Court found in Hudson, they have to make their decision whether or not to object in the dark. And if there's going to be a large class...
I'm sorry, I don't understand that. What is there preventing a Kroger worker from making the same claim that she's making? Why can't the Kroger workers make the same claim she's making right now? Why do they need her?
Well, because she's standing as a class representative. They obviously could bring it, but the power, as the Eighth Circuit found in Bloom, that the charging party stands in the place of the entire class and all those who are similarly situated. And that's what the board sought in this case, and that is also the remedy that is most common, and indeed the normal remedy in Beck cases, is we cite Rochester Manufacturing and the New York NYP Holdings case. The board usually gives retroactive class-wide remedies in these situations. I'm running down a little bit on my time, but generally this court has a long set of cases that say the factory closing, there's no more factory. That doesn't moot a case. There's this court's decision in the ALJ case, said the fact that there was no more parking lot, and they weren't even negotiating over parking lots, that didn't moot the case. The death of the employee in Local 1941 did not moot the case.
I'm just looking back at my notes on Bloom here. My notes say that in Bloom she did not get a refund.
Yes, but the court found alternative third-party standing to seek that same remedy on behalf of everyone. And just like the Supreme Court found in Sosa, after a class is certified, and the class is technically, I would say, certified when the NLRB issues the complaint and seeks a relief for all employees. She stands as a class representative, and the mooting, the possible mooting of her damages claim, does not take away that right to seek a class-wide remedy, just like the mooting of a claim after a class certification does not take away that right.
Does vacature have any practical implications either way?
Well,
what difference does it make?
I think
the board's got its precedent. The board's, whether this decision's there or not, it's not going to make any difference.
Well, I think it does have a practical, is that the board will thumb its nose at the opinion of this court.
Well, it's done that already. I mean, what's the difference?
The general counsel
has a right to do that.
I don't think that the board has a right to not follow the opinion of this court.
You don't?
No. Oh. It's non-acquiescing to the opinion.
Right.
And as we cite in our brief, this is a serious problem. Mm-hmm. We're still arguing. Penrod was decided 16 years ago.
Yes, I know. Abrams well, was,
I know you know very well, Judge Tatel. Abrams was decided 20 years ago.
Yes, right.
And we're still arguing over whether the board
not
has...
Not me. I'm finished.
But the board takes a position on the merits that is inconsistent with every single Hudson case.
Okay.
It's inconsistent with...
If we were to vacate the board's decision in that case, what does that do to the larger issue here?
Well, it would leave the general counsel... The general counsel has ultimate discretion whether or not to bring a complaint. And it would be hard to see how the general counsel would ever bring another complaint based on this issue, because they're going to always point to Sands.
But aren't there similar decisions by the board in other circuits? Reaching the same conclusion?
Reaching the same conclusion as...
Is this the only one?
As the board?
Yeah.
Or as the board in Penrod?
Conflicting with the board in this case.
In this case.
Yeah. Is this the only one?
No, this is not... if you're talking about California Saw, which is the only other case that I'm aware of, this issue wasn't even before the Seventh Circuit in California Saw. And it is a very terse one line that says, this is for the board.
I see.
But... that conflicts the application of Hudson, really, is not, I would argue, for the board, because the board has no deference.
So is your argument that if we granted vacatur in this, mm-hmm. that it would take a tool away from the general counsel? Is that your point?
No. It would give a tool to the general counsel. They would have to issue another complaint, but they would likely never issue another complaint. That's what we state in the briefs, is that they're likely not going to issue another complaint, and they're going to thumb its nose at this court's ruling in Penrod, and they're going to refuse to enforce it in perpetuity.
Okay.
Most likely. Thank you.
Anything else?
No. Okay.
We'll hear from the board. Go ahead.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Engelhardt for the National Labor Relations Board. With respect to mootness, I think at a starting point would be to look at the terms of the complaint and also the charge. In terms of the complaint on Joint Appendix 39, it references the harm personal to Laura Sands. So Laura Sands, it doesn't reference the other members of the bargaining unit or similarly situated employees. Nor does the charge filed by Laura Sands in this case on page 37 reference any other harm other than to Laura Sands. We now know that Laura Sands has been offered the check. We also have heard the argument that she continues to have an interest in receiving a cease and desist order and a notice. I think the Scali and Orsi cases that we've cited to the court suggest that an employee's interest in a notice and cease and desist is no longer a live issue when that employee has left the workplace. And I would like to spend a second talking about Montague, because that's a very interesting case and has a couple of wrinkles that did prevent the board from arguing mootness in that case. There, the employer was an employer of 70 facilities, and the employer itself had been charged of entering into an illegal pre-recognition agreement. While the board did not find a violation, if the court had ordered the board to find one, the board considered it within its jurisdiction to order a cease and desist that would have been 70 facility wide. The facility that the two charging parties, who were petitioners in that case, sought review from, had closed. Normally, that would have affected their standing, except for the fact that if a company-wide notice was to be issued, the board would have ordered that notice have been mailed to them personally. So the interesting wrinkle is that their interest in having a personal notice mailed to them was an aspect of that case. They did prevent the board from suggesting mootness in that case. That's not currently in the case here. I would suggest this case is much more along the lines of a Galley and an Orsi.
What about the check? It's not cashed under Campbell. Ewald, it seems unilateral. There might be a waiver issue, but put that aside for the second. If there's not a waiver issue, isn't this clearly still a live controversy under Campbell-Ewald?
Campbell-Ewald seems to address the question of an unaccepted settlement offer. Mm-hmm. I guess before the court would be the question of whether what was offered here was a settlement offer or full relief. My understanding...
Or offer of judgment, it says, Campbell-Ewald, unaccepted settlement offer or offer of judgment does not moot a plaintiff's case.
My understanding here is that the until the response of yesterday, that the offer was a full settlement of...
How can it be a full settlement if it's not accepted? It was a letter out of the blue, right?
Yes, it was a letter out of the blue in November of 2000.
There's no indication of acceptance, and we know, except the representation, that I assume you know the check hasn't been cashed. So that seems, again, there's a waiver issue, and I'll get to that, but it seems pretty clear it's not moot under Campbell-Ewald.
Well, if that's the opinion of this court, I understand, but it's the board's view that until the representation was made that she'd not cast her, we do not know whether it was even given to her, I guess, at this point. Was it transmitted by her attorneys to her to cash? Did she have the option?
Well, that hurts you, not helps you on mootness, right?
Well, the client's interest, I assume, would be important to know whether the client had been given the check.
Well, we know from all we know from the union's brief is that they just say the check wasn't returned, right? So it wasn't cash. We know that, right?
We have no evidence of it being cashed, yes.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, we know it wasn't, because if it had been, the union would have told us that in its brief, in its 28-J letter, which it didn't, right?
Right.
Okay. By the way, what do you, if we think it's moot, what do you think about vacature?
Well, don't you think? I noticed that Galley did vacate the board's decision. One issue in vacature seems to be whether there's an order to be vacated, and when there's a dismissal of an unfair labor practice, there's no order as such. But I appreciate that the court may have a different view and entertain vacature.
Does the board have a view? Do you care?
I think that the board is agnostic on this point, Your Honor.
Okay.
If I could just say...
I should have used the word agnostic. That's a much better word. Thank you.
I feel that I would be remiss if I didn't say that we've come to a point on this particular issue where the board recognizes so much has happened. But the original concept in Hudson about basic consideration of fairness was in a situation where the actual percentage of reduction was given in Hudson, and the unfairness was that it wasn't accompanied by the additional bundle of rights, the additional bundle to know what chargeable expenses are and what procedures would be available for an employee who wanted to challenge those. And we're now at a point where the complaint in this case alleged that the specific percentage alone was the basic unfairness. And yet that was rejected way back in Hudson, that alone could address the unfairness. The board's entry into this field, which happened after Hudson, which happened after Abrams with the issuance of California Saw, tried to suggest that this bundle was appropriately given at a stage two, and now after the employee has elected to not be a member and to not pay full membership fees. And this complaint has asked that one aspect, the specific percentage, be moved up to stage one. And the board, I believe, has offered a very reasoned view of why its understanding of this area of the law should be given deference, but it recognizes that it is up against precedent of this circuit. That's why we submitted a petition for hearing en banc initially. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything else?
No.
Okay. Mr. Kopis?
J. Jim Kappas for Food and Commercial Workers Local 700. The first point I'd like to make is that a charging party in an unfair labor practice case is most certainly not a class representative. The complaint is brought by the board's general counsel and litigated by the board's general counsel, who controls the theory of the complaint. It's particularly so in this case for the reasons Mr. Engelhardt said, because this case was brought with regard to what happened to an individual employee. The charge was filed on behalf of an individual employee. And contrary to what Ms. Sands' attorney says, in cases like that, the board does not give relief beyond the individual charging parties. The relevant cases are cited in the first Penrod opinion of the board, 327 NLRB at 955, note 31. So Ms. Sands does not stand in the role of a class representative at all. The sole argument made in the briefs was that she's entitled to keep this case alive to seek notice, but she's certainly not a person who's aggrieved by the lack of notice, and that's the statutory requirement, that the person who wants to petition for review has to be aggrieved by the order. The Montague case pointedly did not reach the issue of whether the charging parties in that case were aggrieved, and I'd say that Ms. Sands is certainly not aggrieved by the lack of a notice in her former workplace. As to the supposed back pay liability, this case is nothing like Campbell-Ewald because the union did not make a settlement offer. Ms. Sands was free to take the money. It was given to her without any conditions at all. She's still free to take the money, so there's no dispute about her being...
How's that not like Campbell-Ewald?
That was a settlement offer. There was no tender. There was no tender of money at all in that case. The defendant made a Rule 68 settlement offer and attempted to moot a class action. First of all, this isn't a class action. Secondly, we didn't make a settlement offer. There was no conditions on her cashing the check. We simply said, this is not worth $300. Here's a check. We hope that satisfies you. But that's
not a settlement offer?
A settlement offer is, if you take this, we'll settle the case. This was given unconditionally. The money was just handed to her. That's not a settlement offer by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly not a Rule 68.
So the understanding was, you take the check and we will still see you in court. We'll keep going.
If you want to argue about it, it's not. We're not saying that you're waiving anything by taking the check. We're just saying, here is the money that you paid us. We're returning
it. But it's the money that a court could order, or the board could have ordered to be paid to her.
Well, actually not, as we point out in our footnote, because there's no allegation in this case that Ms. Sand was anything but a full voluntary member for the entire
time.
Put
that aside, if you were not correct on that, the board could order the payment.
Yes, except that the Supreme Court said that they couldn't in Local 60, but yes. Were it not for Local 60 and were the law different. But that's not the case. She has the check. She can probably still cash it. If she can't, we'll write another one. There's just no dispute about the money.
Do you have a view about the waiver issue?
Well, the brief argues only that notice is what keeps the case alive. So if, as the prior arguments indicate, you're not going to entertain arguments that weren't in the brief, right, that certainly was waived here.
Do you have a view about vacatur, if we think it's moved?
It seems to me, in practical terms, we don't really care, but it seems to not make sense legally, because what the court's reviewing is the order of the board, and the order of the board here dismissed the complaint. And so if you vacate the order, the complaint is still dismissed. If it weren't, that would just be tantamount to a remand. So I don't understand how vacating the order makes any sense. And as you point out, the precedent is still there. And the general counsel...
But you don't object to vacater.
I don't object. If the court thinks it makes sense, that's fine with us. Okay. I had hoped to discuss Abrams and Penrod with Judge Tatel. We both have a long history with both those cases, but it sounds like that's not going to be for today.
I think so.
No more questions?
Well, unless my colleagues would like to discuss it with you.
No.
Neither? Okay. No. Sorry, Mr. Kopis. We'll try again another time.
Thank you.
Did counsel have any time left? You can take 2 minutes if you'd like it.
Real quick, I just wanted to make a couple points.
Sure.
On the issue of the practical effect of vacatur is that the similarly situated employees at Kroger who did not receive a proper Beck notice will have no opportunity to retroactively object. And I wanted to point out the complaint is brought on behalf of not only Laura Sands, but
I didn't run that by me again. I didn't understand that.
The complaint
So if we vacate the decision below.
Right. Right.
That will disadvantage Kroger employees who might want to challenge.
Who might want to challenge that they didn't receive a proper back notice and receive a refund. And that's why Sands stands is similarly situated. So I want
I see. So, okay, you'd have to agree with your third-party standard.
Right.
Gotcha.
And so, but I want to point out that Joint Appendix 40, it's paragraph 7 of the complaint, it says, by the conducts described above, respondent has been restraining and coercing not just Laura Sands, but they say employees, not just Laura Sands, but all employees, in the exercise of the rights guaranteed under the Act. And the board, the general counsel, before the ALJ, specifically requested that they provide all bargaining unit employees with the full amount of union dues and the percentage of reduction in dues objecting non-members receive. So the board is the one who made this a similarly situated case. And they're coming up here at the last minute in a case where they didn't really think it was moot. You don't usually petition for en banc review in a case that you think is dead. They're coming up here now saying the exact opposite. Now, I just want to point out one more thing that the board said. They said she doesn't have a personal interest in mootness because those cases were where a notice may be mailed. But the board has a broad remedy and can have the notice mailed here. So contrary to what has been said, Laura Sands may still see it. And Jay Pacini stands for that, is that there's the board has large remedial powers to effectuate an electronic remedy. So unless the, one more thing, I'm over my time. But,
go ahead, you can finish your sentence.
Once we received the check,
we
sent it directly to Laura Sands. I guess if there's any question about it, she's had it since we've received it. So thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.